KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. The U.S. economy shrank in the first 3 months of the year. Growth in consumer spending is slowing, and Americans are increasingly worried that a recession is coming. What's next for the economy on Morning Edition from NPR News? Top immigration official says the Trump administration is not skipping due process as it moves to deport migrants to El Salvador. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. She also promises that deportations will increase in the next 100 days. Also, the administration pulls funding that would have helped local governments prevent damage from disasters. Plus, Cowboy Fashion Alert, a report on what fans wore to Beyonce's latest tour. It is Thursday, May 1st. On this day in 1930, astronomers named the icy rock beyond Neptune Pluto for the god of the underworld who can turn invisible. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A top lawmaker is introducing legislation to increase accountability for federal judges who face allegations of misconduct. NPR's Kerry Johnson reports the bill follows a year-long NPR investigation into abuse and bullying by judges.
Among the judges featured in NPR's reporting, two retired with full benefits while under investigation for mistreating law clerks. But a new bill from Congressman Hank Johnson, a Georgia Democrat, would change that. Johnson says his Trust Act would close a loophole that allows judges to end internal investigations if they retire or resign first. The 30,000 workers in the federal courts are exempt from a key civil rights law, leaving them with few options to seek justice when judges themselves are the wrongdoers. The federal courts have made significant changes to their internal system since the Me Too movement, but many employees say they're leery of reporting problems when judges judge each other. Kerry Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
This week, Trump administration officials have been highlighting the president's work on his first 100 days in office. Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller has been speaking from the White House this morning about Trump's efforts to restore, quote, common sense. Miller has touched on some issues that are considered part of the culture wars. He singled out colleges and universities for work on diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Universities across this country are in plain and direct violation of the Supreme Court's ruling that affirmative action, as in racial quotas and set-asides, are illegal. Students must be admitted to universities on a colorblind basis.
Earlier this week, President Trump's border czar and Treasury Secretary also spoke from the White House about the Trump administration's accomplishments. Stocks opened higher this morning after Microsoft and Facebook's parent company reported better-than-expected profits for the most recent quarter. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 210 points in early trading.
Stock in Microsoft and Facebook's parent Meta both got a boost from the tech giant's strong financial results, but things are not so shiny at the Golden Arches. McDonald's says sales at its existing restaurants in the U.S. fell more than 3.5%. That could be a sign the fast food chain's budget-conscious customers are feeling particularly squeezed. General Motors is lowering its profit forecast for the year as a result of President Trump's auto tariffs. The automaker expects those import taxes will cost between $4 and $5 billion. New applications for unemployment benefits jumped last week. 241,000 people applied for jobless aid. We'll get a more complete look at the April job market tomorrow. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are now up 220 points. The NASDAQ is up 1.5%. This is NPR. The Trump administration is tapping more federal agencies to help carry out its immigration enforcement policies. According to the Washington Post, that includes using law enforcement officers with the U.S. Postal Service. The Postal Service has not replied to NPR's request for comment. A senior official with the Department of Homeland Security says the Trump administration will use all available resources to secure the border. Los Angeles County has approved what lawyers say is the largest legal settlement for sexual assault claims in U.S. history. From LAist News, Jordan Running reports, this comes after the state of California temporarily waived its statute of limitations on childhood sexual abuse claims.
The $4 billion settlement stems from a lawsuit filed in 2021, with claims from two women who say they were abused as children in county foster care. The lawsuit grew to include 7,000 people who say they were sexually assaulted as children while at Los Angeles County facilities. Mary Alice Ashbrook is one of the survivors involved in the settlement.
Well, I'm grateful that we were finally heard. This happened to me when I was 8 and 9. I was the kid that just sat under the tree and stayed quiet because I knew the ramifications if I didn't.
Ashbrook, now 65, says she hopes the settlement will lead to reforms to protect children in the county's care. For NPR News, I'm Jordan Running in Pasadena, California.
Former Vice President Kamala Harris has given her first major speech since losing the presidential election last year. Speaking in San Francisco, Harris said President Trump is using fear tactics to implement what she calls a far-right agenda. You're listening to NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a top immigration official who says due process looks different for migrants the administration calls terrorists. But first, the economy during the Trump administration's first 100 days has been rocky.
Economic output shrank during the first 3 months of the year. And we asked Americans how it feels to hear that news. Jeremy Rice of Lexington, Kentucky, co-owns a home decor shop called House and remembers other slumps.
So first we had the housing crisis, then we had COVID. We look at this as like the next battle.
His shop sells faux flowers, mainly shipped from China. The business is not recession-proof.
How much are people really going to be able to spend when your industry or what you offer isn't something that's life dependent, right? Like you don't have to have something pretty to live.
Cindy Ayers Elliott is CEO of Footprint Farms in Jackson, Mississippi. She's lost grants from the U.S. Department of Agriculture and her costs have gone up.
It's not just automotive parts. It's also food and fertilizer and gas that you use to fuel your equipment. If it costs me more to produce, it's going to cost my neighbor or my client more to buy.
Maureen Hatfield is a retired letter carrier in Haines City, Florida. She's concerned about housing and rising prices.
I manage on a limited budget, but it's tighter and tighter at the store. Like we all joke about the price of eggs, but it really is ridiculous.
So what's in store for the next 100 days and beyond?
NPR's Scott Horsley is with us now to talk about the economic outlook. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning.
So yesterday we learned that the U.S. economy contracted during the first quarter of the year. Is the second quarter looking any better?
Not so far. The first quarter was all about people bracing for the president's trade war. April, which marks the start of the second quarter, is when those tariffs really started to bite. And that has rattled financial markets. It's also made consumers nervous that prices are going to go up. Chief economist Greg Dacko of EY Parthenon says people are being more careful about their spending, especially when it comes to things like eating out.
We did see a bit of a step back in spending on restaurants and bars. And with income trends starting to cool quite significantly, that is an additional headwind for many families across the country in terms of their ability to spend on discretionary items.
As we know, consumer spending is the lifeblood of this economy. So when families start to cut back like that, it can really put the brakes on economic growth.
You know, in order to spend money, people usually have to make money. So how's the job market holding up?
So far, the job market's been very resilient. Unemployment in March was just 4.2%. We're going to get the April jobs numbers tomorrow. Forecasters expect to see some slowdown in hiring. In general, workers say they're feeling a little less confident about job security. Seth Lillivivat is in that camp. He's still working for a biotech company in San Diego, but his employer has already had two rounds of job cuts this year.
I'm anxious about the prospect of being laid off from work. This is just the beginning. I'm like, there's going to be more.
Lillivivat's also a little worried about the drop in his retirement savings. You know, the S&P 500 index is down about 7% since Inauguration Day. So Lillivivat's being more conservative about his own spending. That means no more stopping for coffee and pastries after swim practice every week. And he has put off a little home improvement project that he had been planning for this year.
I just feel like the best thing to do is just save and then just try to stay calm. You know, we're all sort of in the same boat.
Right now, that boat is getting tossed around a little bit by the economic headwinds. So it's no wonder, Michelle, some people are feeling a little seasick.
Yeah, how about that? You know, a lot of people say they're worried about a recession. Is that where we're headed?
Not necessarily, although the risk of a recession has certainly increased since the president launched his trade war. We've already seen a substantial slowdown in cargo traffic, especially from China, where those crippling tariffs are in effect. Gene Soroka, who runs the ordinarily busy port of Los Angeles, says that's going to hit the paychecks of a lot of transportation and warehouse workers.
We're not going to put longshoremen and women out of work, but they'll probably get less hours because fewer containers are coming in. The truck drivers may not haul as many boxes every day as they do right now. Global trade will slow, prices will increase, and it will impact jobs across America and the world.
Now, Greg Dacko says whether we actually fall into recession could depend on whether Trump's tariffs remain in place or get watered down. Even if the tariffs are rolled back, Dacko warns, we're likely to be looking at fairly sluggish growth for the rest of this year.
That is NPR's Scott Horsley. Scott, thank you.
You're welcome.
One of President Trump's top priorities is immigration and border security. As part of NPR's coverage of the administration's first 100 days, I spoke with someone who has a key role in U.S. border enforcement efforts, Tricia McLaughlin. She is the top spokesperson for the Department of Homeland Security as Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs. Madam Assistant Secretary, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Michelle, thanks for having me on.
So let me just take a step back. How would you define philosophically the administration's approach in these first 100 days to immigration policy?
I think we're doing exactly what the president promised that he would do November 5th, 2024. This was the mandate the American people gave him to do, which is to secure the border, secure the homeland.
The White House set some high targets for arrests and deportations at the beginning of this term, but it seems like it's been harder to meet those because so few people are crossing into the U.S. from the southern border. And in fact, that decrease in crossings had happened before the president took office. So how do you think you're doing on those metrics?
I think that we've seen a lot of success at the border itself. We were just down in El Paso with Secretary Noem, and it was quiet. We really just saw our Border Patrol agents. We were not seeing migrants crossing. But as far as in the interior of our country, our ICE agents, they've really been hamstrung for the last 4 years and in so many instances vilified for simply doing their jobs and trying to get criminal illegal aliens off of our streets. And so what we're doing is a change in the culture this first 100 days, and we are seeing success, but we're going to see those numbers increase in the next 100 days.
So the president is using tools that previous presidents have not used in peacetime, declaring a national emergency at the southern border, invoking the Alien Enemies Act. Does the DHS believe that this Civil War era act allows them to skip normal immigration court proceedings and due process?
Absolutely not. We don't believe that this allows us to skip due process, nor are we skipping due process. We are abiding every day by due process that is guaranteed in the U.S. Constitution. The key word is due. the Supreme Court has recognized that the amount of process that is due varies based on the situation. So whether that person is an illegal alien, a member of Tren de Aragua, a member of another terrorist organization, that process is going to look different.
But the issue is, I mean, and I think this is something that the president has talked about a lot, is that there have been a number of judges complaining about the administration's tactics, demanding more information, saying that the administration is being evasive in court proceedings. Is there an attempt to force a confrontation with the courts to define this authority and to define it in a more expansive fashion than has been interpreted in the past?
We knew we were facing an uphill battle with these courts. We knew that there would be activist judges as we entered this administration, and that is why the president is giving the American people and the government who is executing on the mandate of the American people every tool at our disposal to get out the people who have illegally entered this country.
I don't know who you're calling activist judges, because a number of the judges who've objected to the administration's tactics in court have been appointed by Republicans, and in some cases by President Trump
himself.
Sure, I
can point exactly who I'm talking about if you'd like.
Well,
Wisconsin judge.
Forgive me,
sure.
I'm not trying to litigate each case here. That's not what we're here to do. What I'm asking you philosophically, does the administration have a strategy of trying to force confrontations with these judges in order to expand the limits of its executive authority?
Again, we are executing on the will of the American people, and we will use the tools at our disposal, including the Alien Enemies Act, which the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that we could use and we will continue to use.
So the department has made some mistakes. So there is a U.S. citizen named Juan Carlos Lopez Gomez, who was arrested by ICE in Florida. There is a U.S. citizen named Jose Hermosillo, who was held in New Mexico for some days. There is an incident in Oklahoma where a family that had recently moved there from Maryland, who say they are U.S. citizens, who had just moved into this house. Their home was raided. The agents, you know, ransacked the house in their telling. It took their private property as evidence, they say. What is the administration doing to make sure that these mistakes don't continue to happen?
I want to speak directly to that Oklahoma case. That was actually a large-scale operation where we did interdict 8 human traffickers. It was ultimately a successful operation. Unfortunately, the warrant that the court did give was for a house that the targets had moved out of 2 weeks prior. So that was not an ideal situation, obviously. We know that our ICE agents across the country are following proper protocol and proper procedures, and we are working every day to make ourselves excellent for the American people.
What I'm asking you is, when persons have been wrongly identified, as seems to have been the case here, and have been treated in a manner that is frightening to them, what redress do they have? Or is the administration prepared to apologize to them? Are they offering them some compensation for this?
Of course, we do internal investigations and we make sure that these kind of things don't happen again. We are striving for excellence. We are striving to best serve the American people.
So before we let you go, let's look ahead. So now that the administration has put a lot of effort into its deportation efforts, what are the efforts going forward? Is there going to be an effort to achieve some sort of a comprehensive immigration reform system? What can we look forward to in the next 100 days?
Oh, absolutely. I think that we're going to see an increase in interior operations. Many who are in Florida probably heard about Operation Tidal Wave, where we pulled almost 1,000 criminal aliens, including MS-13 members, rapists, murderers convicted off of our streets. We're going to see more of our use of 287G authorities, which is deputizing state and local law enforcement to carry out immigration enforcement action. But I think we're also going to be looking more broadly at our legal immigration system and making sure we have increased vetting. We saw that there was a lot of exploitation, particularly CBP-1 and other parole programs under the past administration, then that's something we're going to really look to fix so that we know who is in this country.
That is Tricia McLaughlin. She's Assistant Secretary of Public Affairs at the Department of Homeland Security. Madam Assistant Secretary, thank you so much for joining us once again. I do hope we'll talk again.
Thank you, Michelle. You too.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Terry Gross pays tribute to her late husband, Grammy Award-winning jazz critic Francis Davis, who died on April 14th. Terry is going to talk about him, read excerpts of his award-winning writing, and play some of the music he wrote about. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. The Trump administration is pulling back from major areas of government spending, slashing budgets for public health, environmental protection, and education. That includes a freeze on more than $2 billion in federal funding to Harvard University, a move meant to punish the school for rejecting new political oversight. Harvard is suing the administration, and some big donors are stepping up. But what happens when public money disappears and it's a billionaire's checkbook that fills the gap? A. Martinez spoke with Teddy Schleifer about that. He's a reporter who covers philanthropy and political power for the New York Times.
So when private donors step in to replace public funding, I mean, what kind of influence does that buy?
You know, as a private institution, right, you are not accountable to the public, theoretically. The twist on that, though, is that lots of these private schools take plenty of public funding, and that gives Trump leverage to sort of twist them and make them beg and make them maybe bend the knee in a way that if they were totally privately funded, these institutions could give Trump the middle finger even more. But the reality is every kind of institution of higher ed is somewhat publicly funded, except for in extreme cases, and that gives the President of the United States leverage to withhold money.
You know, outside education, we've seen foundations ramp up grant making. I know former New York City mayor and billionaire Michael Bloomberg has a pledge to cover U.S. funding for global climate work. Are these kind of things, Teddy, stopgaps or donors trying to set new agendas?
You know, I think the Bloomberg example is interesting. I would argue that that is actually a bit of the exception. I think what we're seeing right now is lots of philanthropists saying that they are unable to kind of be that bulwark against federal funding cuts, especially in a global context. You've seen lots of foundations either say explicitly or sort of implicitly message that they don't have enough money to do this sort of thing. If the U.S. government is going to stop funding USAID, for instance, which I think takes like $40 billion a year, like there's no foundation in the world or no rich person in the world who could, you know, come up with $40 billion a year to be that replacement funding. So I don't even know if there are even really stopgaps. I think there's been in the charitable sector a lot of hands being thrown up and a belief that there's no real way to cover Trump's subtractions.
What worries these big time donors right now? I mean, are they genuinely concerned about public services collapsing, or are they maybe more focused on protecting their causes and reputations?
You know, I think lots of philanthropists are torn because they want to speak up enough to protect kind of the grantees from Trump, but they don't want to speak up too much, so much that they attract Trump's unwanted attention. You know, I think you look at institution like the Gates Foundation right now. A lot of grantees or partners of the foundation are facing existential threats to their humanity. Take USAID. The Trump administration has gutted that agency, and Bill Gates and his philanthropic aides are concerned, but they don't want to say too much because they don't want the retribution campaign that has targeted USAID to come for Bill Gates himself.
You think we're seeing maybe a permanent shift here where public services increasingly depend on private donors?
That's true in some places for a while now. You know, a shrinking public sector can reward and empower a private sector and a billionaire class that is richer than ever. And that comes with trade-offs. You know, like sometimes, you know, you hear private philanthropists defend themselves where they say, hey, what do you want me to do? Like, put the money under my mattress or spend it on yachts? Like, to be involved, yes, it makes me more powerful and it gives me, you know, the ability to put my own business interests and commingle those with my grantees' interests. But if the public sector is shrinking, wouldn't you rather have the private sector involved than not? That's sort of the counter argument that lots of wealthy people make, is that the alternative world where the public sector is shrinking and the private sector is shrinking is the worst outcome. So if you're a nonprofit or you're a higher ed institution or a lab, a research lab out there, the worst case scenario might be for everyone to ignore you. But there is sort of this seesawing that happens between the private sector and the public sector with regards to philanthropy and taxes and federal spending, where it always feels like if you're a grantee, you are choosing, you know, your best tormentor. You know, you're choosing the institution and the funding source that is the least bad, but everything's a little bad.
That's Teddy Schleifer, reporter at the New York Times, covering politics and billionaires. Teddy, thanks a lot.
Sure thing.
We snap in.
Pretty place.
Beyonce's Cowboy Carter tour kicked off this week in LA.
We want to welcome you to the Beyonce Cowboy Carter Act 2.
It's a celebration of all things country, Beyonce style, the music and the fashion.
Whenever you go to a Beyonce show, it's like going to the Met Gala. So you have to make sure you show up correct.
That's Beyonce fan Dylan Frelo, better known on social media as Dylan the Celebrity. And he says dressing to the nines is a must.
I laid out my clothes. Every single piece that I was wearing was custom made, all the way from that top of the hat all the way to the bottom of the boot.
And it seemed like every fan had their own take on the Cowboy Carter aesthetic.
There were a lot of cowboy hats, cowboy boots, denim on denim.
That's Cache McClay, USA Today Network's Beyonce reporter. She was there opening night. McClay says Western wear is hot right now, thanks in part to the album.
We saw a spike in searches for cowboy core items like cowboy hats and fringe and Western fashion.
Mercedes Metz is the founder of a luxury cowboy hat brand. Her custom-made hats go for $285, and she keeps selling out.
Since the announcement of her tour, I've honestly been trying to keep up with the demand for the hats, and that has been a challenge, a good challenge.
She credits none other than Beyonce herself.
She is the music, the movement, and the moment, period.
And the 2 weeks after the song Levi's Jeans came out, it boosted Levi's sales by $1.2 million, according to the data company Launchmetrics. Dylan the Celebrity says upscale brands are also hitching themselves to the Beyonce wagon.
I mean, look at Louis Vuitton. They got people that have probably never even seen a cow wearing a cowboy hat. You know what I mean?
Beyonce fan Bree Geiger has a concert ticket for this summer, and she's excited.
I think it's definitely welcoming into cowboy culture in the sense of honoring ancestors and this history of it and kind of honing on the culture that it is, like American culture.
So Layla, you know I'm going to ask, Do you have any cowboy gear?
Nothing. Do you?
You know I do. But okay, so just remember this advice from Dylan the Celebrity.
Just go get your looks ready, girl, and go to the road, yeah.
This is NPR News.
Alabama now has two black members of Congress out of its 7 seats in the House of Representatives.
It's about fair representation. It's about just making sure you have someone that cares about your community.
I'm Juana Summers. Black voters there are embracing the progress, even as the Trump administration is pulling back federal diversity initiatives. More on All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. First-time jobless claims in the U.S. are at their highest level in 2 months. The Labor Department says they rose by 18,000 last week. It comes a day after the Commerce Department reported the U.S. economy shrank in the first quarter as President Trump implemented sweeping tariffs. The contraction of 0.3% was the first quarterly decline in economic growth since 2022. President Trump will be traveling to Alabama today to speak in advance of the University of Alabama's spring commencement. As Noelle Ananin with member station WBHM reports, some students are planning to protest the president's visit.
UA Student Democrats President Braden Vick says he's concerned President Trump's visit has become too much of a distraction.
The president has taken the focus off of the graduates. The commencement ceremony is for us. It's not for the president. He's not graduating.
UA College Republicans released a statement saying they are proud to welcome Trump and disappointed in the, quote, inflammatory response from their liberal counterparts who they say do not represent their student body. Some students are planning to protest. The Trump administration's recent targeting of non-citizens in higher education led to an Alabama PhD student being detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement earlier this year. For NPR News, I'm Noelle Ananin in Birmingham.
This is NPR News from Washington. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says more women in the U.S. died around the time of childbirth last year. The increase follows 2 years of declines. According to provisional data, there were 688 deaths nationwide during pregnancy, childbirth, or up to 42 days after. The CDC says the leading causes of death were excessive bleeding, blockages, and infections. Researchers say exercise can reduce the side effects associated with cancer treatment. NPR's Maria Godoy says that's the finding of a new comprehensive review.
Exercise can counter side effects from cancer treatment, such as brain fog and nerve and heart damage. The researchers say exercise also seems to boost psychological well-being for those undergoing treatment, and it can improve their sleep quality and overall quality of life. Current guidelines recommend that people with cancer regularly engage in both aerobic exercise and resistance training. The researchers say evidence suggests mind-body exercises such as Tai Chi and yoga are also helpful for enhancing well-being in patients. The review evaluated existing pooled data analyses of randomized controlled trial results published between 2012 and 2024. The findings appear in the British Journal of Sports Medicine. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
Stocks are higher on Wall Street. The Dow's up 273 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at CySimsFoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Tensions between India and Pakistan often run hot and cold, and now they're running hot after a militant attack killed 26 people in Indian-controlled Kashmir.
The militants fled and a manhunt is ongoing. Since then, armies from the two countries are exchanging sporadic gunfire at the border almost every day.
To explain what's going on, we've called NPR's Dia Hadid. She covers Pakistan and India from her base in Mumbai. Hello, Dia. Thanks for joining us once again.
Thank you, Michelle.
So let's start here. What happened that led to this?
Well, last week, gunmen opened fire on tourists in a meadow that's in Indian-controlled Kashmir. It's a territory claimed by Pakistan and India, and both countries control parts of it. But this attack was pretty harsh. Eyewitnesses reported that some gunmen asked their victims if they were Muslim, and if they weren't, they shot them. So most of the killed were Hindu men, and the attack felt visceral in this Hindu-majority nation. Praveen Donti is from the International Crisis Group, and he says that's put pressure on India to respond.
The civilians, you know, 26 of them, they belong to all parts of the country, and it's the first time such a big attack has been mounted on civilians. So there is a lot of anger among the Indian public. They've been baying for blood right now.
So there is pressure on India to respond with retaliatory strikes on Pakistan, but why is India blaming Pakistan for this attack?
Yeah, they're blaming Pakistan because the group that claim responsibility is seen as a proxy for the Pakistani army. Now, Pakistan denies any connection and has called for a neutral investigation, but that hasn't mollified India. It quickly announced it was withdrawing diplomats, it shuttered down a border crossing, and it suspended a water-sharing agreement that Pakistan sees as existential to its survival. So Pakistan's announced similar measures and it's banned trade with India.
Has there been violence since the initial shootings?
Yeah, Michelle, like you mentioned earlier, there's been near daily exchanges of gunfire. Residents are fleeing the area on both sides. Yesterday, Pakistan said it shot down two Indian drones, and overnight it cancelled commercial flights to Himalayan areas that are close to Kashmir. So analysts say it's now a waiting game, like Milan Vaishnav. He's with the Carnegie Endowment.
There is enormous pressure on Prime Minister Modi to respond with some kind of military maneuver. The nature of this attack crossed, I think, a threshold of brazenness that makes it politically difficult for Modi not to respond militarily.
The problem is, though, it could spin out of control. Both these countries have nuclear weapons.
Now, the U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has been calling on both sides to de-escalate. Is there any chance of that, any sign of that happening?
Yeah, there could be, but analysts say this is part of the problem in South Asia. There's a pattern of India and Pakistan escalating and then waiting for outsiders to de-escalate the crisis. One Pakistani columnist, Arif Anur, recently wrote about this.
India and Pakistan don't just walk into a war by accident. There is this entire expectation that somebody is going to talk us off the ledge. The talking off the ledge is the responsibility of the international community.
So now we're waiting to see if Rubio can talk Pakistan and India off the ledge.
That is NPR's Dia Hadid in Mumbai. Dia, thank you.
You're welcome, Michelle.
Local governments around the country are scrambling to replace funding for infrastructure projects. That's because the Trump administration is canceling billions of dollars in grants that were already awarded. The funding was meant to prevent damage from disasters that are getting worse. Lauren Summer from NPR's Climate Desk reports.
When it rains a lot in DePue, Illinois, Daniel Hoffert worries that people won't be able to flush their toilets. He's the village president there. And in heavy rain, flood water pours into their sewage treatment plant.
Once it would flood into the system, it would actually shut down the whole sewage treatment plant. And then we would be in a major hurt.
That's because when the plant stops working, sewage starts backing up in the pipes, even spilling into the basements of people's houses.
Probably a good 125 of them had some infiltration of water into the basement. Not all sewer, but, you know, water.
The problem is that DePue's sewage treatment plant is in a low-lying area, and it needs to be moved. The cost to build a new one would be about $25 million, way out of reach for the small rural community.
That's more tax money than we'll get in 25 years, maybe 50 years.
So Hoffert applied to a federal grant program run by FEMA, known as BRIC, Building Resilient Infrastructure and Communities. It was started during Trump's first term. After years of working on the grant, DePue heard the money was on its way. But earlier this month, the Trump administration canceled the grant program, including grants like DePue's, which had already been awarded but not paid out yet.
It was probably within a month or two of being okay. So that's really harsh.
In a statement, FEMA says the grant program is being canceled because it's ineffective and part of an effort to root out waste and fraud. Hoffert takes issue with that.
I don't think they know what waste is. I don't think they know what fraud is. None of this, to me, is wasteful and fraud.
DePew, Illinois is one of hundreds of local governments around the country who are seeing their FEMA funding canceled. Kristen Smith, who researches disaster funding at the think tank Headwaters Economics, says the projects are designed to cope with disasters like hurricanes, tornadoes, and floods, which are getting more intense as the climate gets hotter.
They're often really essential infrastructure. These projects save lives, protect property, and reduce long-term costs.
The BRIC program also marked a key shift for FEMA, Smith says. Instead of just paying for damage after disasters, it was designed to prevent that damage from happening in the first place.
Programs like BRIC really help us avoid these ballooning disaster costs that we've seen by simply being more proactive. We can pay a little bit now or a lot more tomorrow.
The biggest impact is being felt by small rural communities like Kamiai, Idaho. Deputy City Clerk Mike Tornatore has worked for years on a grant to prepare for wildfires.
This community, due to the age of it, the building materials that were used at that time, we are ripe for a fire to sweep through this community and burn it to the ground.
Kamiai was planning on setting up a grant program to help homeowners make their houses more resistant to wildfires if they can't afford it themselves. That includes replacing older wood roofs and clearing flammable brush.
I have 30 people waiting to receive these grants, but I'll find another way for them. I will, and it's what I have to do.
Tornatore knows that won't be easy. There's no local resources, and state funds are a drop in the bucket compared to what the federal government can offer. But he says the risk of disasters is simply too great to do nothing. Lauren Sommer, NPR News.
Palantir is a powerful and mysterious data analytics company that's gaining new influence in the Trump White House. Hear more about what work it's doing for the federal government this afternoon on All Things Considered. Listen on your radio, in the NPR app, or on your smart speaker. Ask for your local station by name. This is NPR News.
The play John Proctor is the Villain turns Arthur Miller's Crucible on its head. It's told from the perspective of teens dealing with their own issues at home and school. Next time, Here and Now.
The latest in national politics, inspiring podcasts, and a report from your local school board meeting last week. You can hear it all in one place with the NPR app. Download it today. Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. Aztec legend describes axolotls as a god in salamander form. They're amphibians with faces that look like they're always smiling. Think real-life squishmallows. Once upon a time, the waters of Mexico City were teeming with them, but pollution and urban sprawl left them on the brink of extinction. But a team of researchers reported in the journal PLOS ONE that creatures bred in captivity and released in artificial wetlands all thrived. So hopefully, the legend will live on. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Now a story about how a glimpse of beauty from an ugly chapter in American history is being preserved. Indian boarding schools were run by the federal government and churches for more than a century for the purpose of stripping indigenous children of their cultural identities. Thousands were taken from their families, forbidden to wear traditional clothing or speak native languages, and many suffered physical and sexual abuse. But at one school in Utah, students were encouraged to express themselves through art. Macy Lipkin with member station KUER reports on an exhibition of work from students.
People pack into the Nora Eccles Harrison Museum of Art at Utah State University for an opening reception recently. They're here to see murals and photographs from the former Intermountain Indian School.
This shows a lot about the Navajo Reservation.
Lorena Antonio is a retiree from Salt Lake City and a leader among Intermountain alumni. She's looking at a photograph of a mural from the now demolished school. It shows the orange sand and rocks of Monument Valley.
That's the way our land is back home, a lot of open spaces.
In a corner, a mural saved from the school shows a family standing outside a hogan. That's a traditional Diné or Navajo home. Orange buttes stand tall against a blue sky. Other Diné pass by in a string of covered wagons. It's called Returning Home. A student at Intermountain painted it in the 60s. Antonio says she sees the artist's homesickness. She came to Intermountain when she was 10.
Because I was so young, I didn't understand. When I first got there, I really cried because I didn't know where I was.
The federal government ran the Intermountain Indian School from 1950 to 1984. More than 20,000 Navajo students attended over the years, as did kids from other tribes. Utah State University bought the land nearly three decades later. A faculty member cut some murals from the walls before the buildings were torn down. 11 restored murals are on display for the first time. Others only exist as photos now. The school was a veritable gallery of art by the 80s, according to the book Returning Home, Diné Creative Works from the Intermountain Indian School. Diné historian Farina King is a co-author. She says the student artwork speaks to humanity,
such as the very questions of what it means to be human, what does home mean, what is the relationship between people and land and water.
Intermountain began as a school for Navajo youth, but in the 70s, it opened to all Native children in the U.S. Fights sometimes broke out among students of different tribes. But Lorena Antonio also remembers classmates sharing their cultures and feelings through art.
It got to be an art competition between the Navajo and the intertribal.
Well-known Apache artist Alan Hauser established the school's art program. His murals inspired students to paint traditional landscapes and figures on the walls. As the school became more diverse, so did the art. One photo shows two dancers painted next to each other. The colors and clothes reflect different tribes. Other portraits show men who are Thana-Otham and Northern Paiute. King says there's a lot to learn today from what Native students crafted.
They were planting seeds for the future, even while it also was at that time for them serving different purposes too, whether it was bringing that peace and harmony into their lives in some very tumultuous times for them.
The show of murals and photos from the Intermountain Indian School is on display through the middle of January. For NPR News, I'm Macy Lipkin in Logan, Utah.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin.
It is a confusing time to be shopping for a house.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on Think or Swim. More at schwab.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. Stock indicators jumped upward this morning after some better-than-expected results from tech companies. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that.
Tech futures rose after the latest earnings reports from Meta and Microsoft. Meta revenue was up 16% year over year. The average price per ad was also up. And CEO Mark Zuckerberg says Meta is making good progress on AI glasses and Meta AI. Microsoft reported quarterly net income of more than $25 billion, an increase of 18% for the quarter. Investors were also buoyed by reports from Chinese state media that the U.S. had reached out to Beijing to set up talks over tariffs. A social media account affiliated with state media said there's little downside in exploring that. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
With Microsoft up 9.4% and Meta Facebook up more than 6% at the moment, the NASDAQ index is up 2.3%, the S&P up 1.4%. I see the Dow up 329 points, 0.8%. But McDonald's stock down 1% after its quarterly results this morning showed surprise weakness for global sales. As we use President Trump's 100 days as an invitation to review the overhaul so far, what does a political scientist think who whispers into the ears of corporations trying to navigate these uncertain times? We're joined now by Ian Bremmer, founder and president of the political risk consultancy Eurasia Group. Ian, great to have you back.
David, always good to talk to you.
You've written this, but say it aloud for us. The tariff policy is the most what?
It's the greatest act of geopolitical self-harm I've seen in my career as a political scientist.
All right. But what about as a bargaining tool for the Trump administration to get some countries talking about their trade policies and other arrangements? It works that way to some extent.
It should work that way. And the U.S. is, of course, the strongest economy. It's the most powerful country in the world. But for example, if the United States is trying to get a whole bunch of countries that are aligned to work with the Americans to push the Chinese hard to further de-risk, to decouple specifically in areas that are important for national security, the worst way to go about that is to pick on your friends at the same time.
And on the subject of prompting or forcing negotiations by jacking up tariffs, does that work with China actually in practice?
No, it's going to work with a bunch of weaker countries, smaller countries, countries that desperately need a deal with the U.S. With the Chinese, they aren't even talking to the United States about trade. And the fact is that they can take a significant hit. This is going to be about 2% of their GDP, but they are convinced that they can outlast the Americans politically in terms of pain they take. And they also see themselves as major long-term beneficiaries as other countries around the world hedge more towards China. And as the Americans refuse leadership in multilateral institutions with the Global South and lots of other areas where the Chinese are the number two player, they'll become more dominant.
One last question here. I guess it gets at the new world of trade and new alignments that emerge. Does it matter outside of India when you see that workers in India will put together the iPhones that Chinese people have been assembling and then Americans have been buying?
Yes. China has an economy that has not been performing very well. So the fact that the United States and other countries have been trying to de-risk and now Trump is leaning into a very tough, basically a trade embargo position on the Chinese, that's going to be a benefit to India first and foremost. But also Vietnam and countries across Southeast Asia, that I think is going to be a long-term structural move.
Ian Bremmer, founder and president of the Eurasia Group, the political risk consultancy. Always good to catch up.
David, a pleasure.
And here's President Trump yesterday on his tariffs, China profiting from things Americans buy, and the possibility of hardship at the toy store ahead of Christmas and Hanukkah.
They made $1 trillion with Biden, $1 trillion, even $1.1 trillion. With Biden selling us stuff. Much of it we don't need. You know, somebody said, oh, the shelves are going to be open. Well, maybe the children will have two dolls instead of 30 dolls, you know? And maybe the $2 will cost a couple of bucks more than they would normally.
It's now May, and we can look back at the stock market's performance for turbulent April. Enormous swings with tariff turnarounds, but in the end, the S&P for the month lost only 0.7%. The NASDAQ lost 0.8% for the month.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals who want to join an inclusive and unique culture. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And by Mercury. Mercury offers banking and financial software to help businesses do more in one place. Learn more at mercury.com.
So the stock market's been volatile. So's the housing market these days. While a surge of people entered into contracts to buy new places to live in March, if you compare existing home actual sales in March to a year earlier, sales were down in some regions, including the Midwest and the South. In the West, they were up, in the Northeast holding steady, using data from the National Association of Realtors. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has that.
In some ways, this spring's housing market is deja vu all over again.
We're still in this stalemate phase that we've been in for a long time.
Chris Salviati, senior housing economist at Apartment List, says affordability, or the lack thereof, is still the main issue.
We're really not through the crazy price increases that we saw a few years ago, right? Where we saw the median monthly mortgage payment double in the course of a few years.
Today, home prices are still growing, though much more slowly, and mortgage rates have come down a little.
The challenge is, of course, that housing conditions are easier to navigate, but economic ones aren't.
Allie Wolf, chief economist at Zonda, says uncertainty in the economy is a huge factor in the current housing market. People are wondering,
is my job safe? Will the economy go into a recession? What do these tariffs mean for me? If you're trying to make the biggest purchase of your life, do you really want to do it if you have no sense of what the next 6 months look like?
For a lot of people, she says, the answer right now is no. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
And in Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. It's the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media. We'll be right back.